The first half hour of Issues Etc. today will dovetail to a certain degree with a running conversation we've been having for about 2 weeks. Actually, it's been a longer conversation than that, but the intensity of the conversation has picked up a bit in the last several weeks. We'll be talking about the goals of the homosexual movement during the first half hour of Issues Etc. today. Craig Osten, Vice President of Creative Services for the Alliance Defense Fund, will be our guest in the first half hour of Issues Etc. today. In the second half hour, Craig Parton, author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for August, called The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel, will join us to talk about defending the faith to those, you know, most of the time when Christian apologetics takes place, it's done on the basis of the facts, the objective facts. But what if someone has an objection based on feelings? How do you deal with the tender-minded when doing Christian apologetics? That'll be the subject of our conversation with Craig Parton in the second part of the first hour. In the second hour of the program, the entire hour, Bob Liko joins us. He's co-founder of Discernment Ministry International. We'll talk about the signs of an abusive church, or you could simply say the signs of any abusive movement, whether it calls itself Christian or not, but we'll be focusing on his experience coming out of an abusive Christian church, and we'll find out how to recognize it in the second hour of the program. The third hour, Eunice Ray joins us from RSVP America. The Kinsey Report on Sexual Behavior in the Human Female was issued 50 years ago today. That controversial report literally changed the face of America's thinking on human sexuality. We'll find out whether that report held any water when we talk with Eunice Ray in the third hour of Issues Etc. A little bit of open line sprinkled in there in that third hour for your questions and your comments. What will we be talking about? I open my file and I see that the British Church has decided that they need the help of some advertising consultants. More than that, they've actually hired an advertising firm, ironically called Chameleon Advertising. Their suggestion, in order to bring people back to this church, once a church that spanned the globe, now in Great Britain at least, we're talking about single-digit attendance on the average Sunday. In order to bring people back to the church, no more crucifixes, no more crosses, no more crucifixion, period. Emphasize the social benefits of being a member of the church. You'll hear more about that in the third hour of Issues, etc. Not unlike what's happening here in the American church, is it? Craig Osten is Vice President of Creative Resources for the Alliance Defense Fund. He's co-author of the new book titled The Homosexual Agenda, Exposing the Principal Threat to Religious Freedom Today. Craig, welcome to Issues Etc.
It's good to be with you, Todd. Thank you.
Folks, you can join our conversation 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Craig, first, let's deal with the objection that there is no real movement per se. There's nothing formal called a homosexual movement or a homosexual agenda. How do you respond to that?
How I respond to that is, yes, there is. And the homosexual activists have laid it out in the late 1980s very plainly in an article called The Overhauling of Straight America, and later in a book called After the Ball. They laid out a 6-point agenda for how they were going to change how Americans perceive homosexual behavior and how they were going to be able to implement their entire agenda within about 10 to 15 years.
Give us the bare outlines of that agenda as it was laid out back then.
Basically, how it was laid out was, one, they said, it's done by two homosexual activists named Hunter Matson and Marshall Kirk, and one was they would talk about gays and gayness as loudly and as often as possible. So they went on a big media crusade, you know, with the entertainment media, with the news, to really push the homosexual issue first and foremost. And by doing this, people either would be desensitized to it or just get so tired of the issue that they would just say, I just don't want to deal with it. I don't want to hear about it anymore. Just give them what they want, and hopefully they'll be quiet. The second is to portray gays as victims, which they've done very well, and not as aggressive challengers. You know, the whole tragic murder of Matthew Shepard was the perfect example of that. You know, the two men who murdered Matthew Shepard were not professing Christians. They were basically two thugs, but they turned that around and blamed that murder on people like Dr. James Dobson, on organizations like the Family Research Council, who have just expressed the biblical position with regard to homosexual behavior. The other one is, you know, they say is to make gays look good. So in the media, when you watch a television show, often the homosexual characters are the most stable, the most normal characters on TV. And it's the heterosexual couples who are the ones that are messed up. In fact, in the media, there's so many homosexual characters now that Michael Medved, the film critic, said if a Martian came back to Earth today and watched network television, he'd come to the conclusion there were more homosexuals in America than there are evangelical Christians. And then one of the other methods was to get the support of corporate America, and they've done that twofold. By one, going to corporate America, on one hand, and saying we're an aggrieved class as employees, we need to have special protections in the workplace, but then going to corporate America and saying, hey, look at all the disposable income we have. We're a market you need to tap into. And so they've got in corporate America, basically, two-pronged attack from different directions, totally fueling their agenda.
And to what end do all of these, this kind of multifaceted, multi-front attack basically the family, it sounds like, and on our notion of human sexuality, mm-hmm. to what end is this driving? What's the goal?
The goal is twofold. Is the one on the family issue is the eventual elimination of marriage and the family. They say we just want, you know, for example, same-sex marriage because we want to have, you know, the ability to form stable, you know, unions. This will be good, you know, for marriage in America. But here's some of the quotes from some of the homosexual activists. William Eskridge said that he hoped same-sex marriage would dethrone the traditional family based on blood relationships in favor of the families we choose. Another homosexual activist, Michelangelo Signorelli, he told activists, you know, fight for same-sex marriage and its benefits, and then once granted, redefine the institution of marriage completely to debunk a myth and radically alter an archaic institution. This is the key phrase up here. The most subversive action lesbians and gay men can undertake is to transform the notion of family entirely. What they want is the elimination of marriage and family. So basically, sexuality is unbridled in our culture. There are no restraints. The other thing they want is the church to be totally silenced on the issue. Joe Dallas, who's a former homosexual, said, you could give the homosexual activists everything they want today, same-sex marriage, adoption, the whole bit. They will not be satisfied until the church is silenced on this issue because they cannot deal with the fact. I mean, and then they know that the Bible says homosexual behavior is sinful, so they need to silence that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a lot to deal with here, but maybe we could begin by simply, could you point out to us where the average person would come into contact with the homosexual agenda, and perhaps because of this process of ongoing desensitization, maybe not even be aware that they're seeing the homosexual agenda at work?
Well, for example, one of the places would be in our public school system. The homosexual agenda often comes with kind of buzzwords. You know, if you see the words tolerance or diversity, that's tends to be a red flag. Those have been co-opted by the homosexual movement to include the affirmation of homosexual behavior. So if you're a parent and your child is in the public schools and your child comes home and starts telling you about, oh, we're having this diversity week at school. Well, it's not, you know, sad to say, it's been twisted from racial diversity to sexual diversity in many cases. And many parents are, you know, unaware that these type of things are going on in the public schools, where kids as early as kindergarten, homosexuals are coming in to the classroom to talk about their behavior and in some ways show it to be a preferable behavior, the heterosexual behavior. You know, in the church, you know, often And this is what happened, has gone on in, with many of the mainline denominations. We've just seen what's gone on in the Episcopal Church. When the movement's, quote, towards tolerance and diversity, or the words inclusive, start to come up, it starts to go this way. And eventually, a church, a school, any institution is taken over by it. I have a great quote, just saw it today, by John Derbyshire, who says, "Any organization that admits frank and open homosexuals into its higher levels will sooner or later abandon its original purpose and give itself over to propagating and celebrating the homosexual ethos and to excluding heterosexuals and denigrating heterosexuality." And that is what is beginning to happen in many institutions throughout the country. And people, they start very much at the grassroots level in organizations that, never went near the issue of homosexuality, like the PTA or now, the YWCA, but it's an infiltration, and you really have to monitor it carefully and look for the language.
One of the places I've noticed it, now that I've kind of got my antenna up looking for this in more subtle ways than just obviously noticing that Will and Grace is on television, mm-hmm. or something like that, is in advertising.
Yes.
It's in the blurring of the lines, not so much a depicting gay men or women, but the blurring of the lines between men and women in advertising. I noted just the other night when I was watching a television program, they were talking about the huge gay market.
Yes.
being $451 billion a year of potential, mm-hmm. spending power.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in fact, the average income for a homosexual household is double of that of the traditional family. The latest study in 2000 done by Simmons Research found it to be $85,000 is the annual income. So that's actually 60% higher than the national average. And one-fifth of the respondents had incomes over $100,000. They travel more, and in fact, including according to Simmons Research poll, 50% of homosexual consumers said they buy whatever they want. They've got the disposable income to do that. So advertisers are seeing that, and of course they want the money. And, in many cases, they don't care where it comes from, and so they are tailoring advertisements to that. Subaru Motors has targeted itself towards the lesbian market, having Martina Navratilova, who's a lesbian, doing their commercials, and they have a phrase, we're just built that way. And it's a lesbian, basically it's a lesbian message. It might just go past people, but it's they're saying, homosexuals do, we're just born that way. So the homosexuals pick up on that language. During the Olympics in 2000, John Hancock did a commercial, and it's about this. There's this couple talking about, they're holding a baby, and you don't see it at the end. They're talking about you're going to be a wonderful mother, and you don't see at the end that it's two lesbians holding this baby, and that they are going to be the parents of this child. The interesting one on that was it's a Chinese baby. And when this was brought to attention, that China would start barring adoptions if they found out that homosexual couples were coming over to adopt children. Basically, John Hancock changed the commercial just a little bit so you didn't see the baby, but it was still the lesbians, adopting the child. So whether they're subtle or blatant, you're seeing more and more of these advertisements.
While we're in the kind of the realm of the media with the big advertising, let's talk about the role of popular entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
One need hardly cite examples because there are so many, but cite us a few examples of the homosexual agenda at work in popular entertainment.
Well, basically, the homosexual agenda has been going on for quite some time in entertainment. I mean, as television shows started to denigrate the family, that was one way. And a lot of those shows were written by homosexual writers. And shows that become just so much about just about sex. I mean, every comedy is about sex these days, and that's a desensitization. But of course, you have Will and Grace out there, who, you know, where it's shown to be hip to be homosexual. You'll see other shows. There's one coming on in the fall. I saw an ad for the other night called "It's All Relative," where basically this heterosexual couple finds out they have these homosexual cousins, and of course the homosexual cousins are extremely witty, and the heterosexuals, you know, are just kind of these country bumpkin type people. But it's in the media. It's basically, you know, and there's movies, you know, almost mob movies now will come out like this. When I was talking to my in-laws a few nights ago, they rented the movie The Hours, and they had no idea that it was filled with lesbian behavior. And they were going, my gosh, now what you're writing about, I see. This is just beginning to infiltrate everything in the media.
And now, whereas one might have argued in, say, a decade past, that there was a very subtle message being sent in sitcoms and mm-hmm. evening dramas that homosexuality is both mainstream and acceptable, and of course only the most crass and backward of us would ever consider it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now there seems to be almost playing to the stereotype. We spent yesterday a bit during Open Lines talking about this program called Queer Eye for the Straight
yes.
Guy,
mm-hmm.
and then there's another one out, kind of a matchmaker show called Boy Meets Boy, in which it seems all the stereotypes of the homosexual are being played to by way of, you know, added entertainment value.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, as they're becoming more and more emboldened, and you're beginning to see that, you know, starting to come out. You know, and it's done, though, they're using those stereotypes in a comical way, again, in the method to kind of desensitize people. But you're talking about that Queer Eye program. It's another one where the gays are portrayed as, oh, they've got it together. Yeah, they're stereotypes, but they've got it together, and we've got this poor, clueless straight guy here who needs help of all these homosexual men to get his act together. So you'd be seeing that, and when you go in other countries, eventually, as when you have, gay cable channels and so forth like that, you start to see some of the portrayals of the really seamy side of the lifestyle. And perhaps that's where we are going as well.
Let's talk a bit about the church. You mentioned it before. And it is, you talked about the church being silenced, or actually being silent of its own volition. But
mm-hmm.
it seems as though, at least if the news of the day maybe any indication, there are sectors of the church that have become an ally with the homosexual movement.
Yes, and that's happened, very much in many mainline denominations. I mean, I shared with you the Derbyshire quote earlier with what's gone on in the Episcopal Church. And I grew up in a Methodist church that was eventually taken over by homosexual activists. In fact, the associate pastor left his wife for another man, and things like that. But what's happened is, in the name, using the words love and tolerance and so forth, a lot of churches have, bought into the homosexual agenda, where basically that's all they talk about. We share a story about a minister up in Detroit, a female minister who basically preaches every sermon on homosexual behavior, wears with her robe, her stole, are all these gay pride symbols, the rainbow flag, the AIDS ribbon, all these other things that shows her sympathy with the homosexual movement. Yet, it's a total denial, one, of what the Bible says about homosexuality, and two, how the church is supposed to be towards all those who are in sin, whether it's homosexual behavior or adultery or whatever. Yes, we are to show love, but Christ also said, he showed love, but he also said, go and sin no more. There was a repentance that led along with that, and so many churches have forgotten that. But at the same time, a lot of these churches in the liberal churches, once they moved away from the fundamental understandings of scriptures, from the scripture in the 60s and 70s, once you start throwing out things and saying, well, that's not relevant now, then you're leaving an open door for the acceptance of homosexual behavior as well.
Finally, with only about 2 minutes before we need to go, Craig, the role of government and to what degree government has been complicitous in furthering of the homosexual agenda. Give us the main points.
The main points is that the government right now, the homosexual activists are now using the government to start to silence people of faith. And it's kind of like a noose that is tightening. California is an example where you have a very determined and very strong homosexual caucus in the state legislature with a governor who is totally sympathetic to their cause. So now you have a situation where, you know, these homosexual bills are passed. And at first, they say, oh, there's a religious exemption. Well, then they go back and they keep narrowing the religious exemption until there's nothing left. And a lot of religious organizations give a free pass the first time saying, oh, well, we're protected, so we don't have to worry about that. In California, just beginning of August, Governor Gray Davis signed AB 196, which is a bill that will fine Christian businesses like Christian bookstores, nonprofit groups like the Boy Scouts, $150,000 if they are found not to hire someone because they are a transsexual. And what you're seeing in Canada, you're now seeing people being silenced, being facing criminal charges for talking about homosexual behavior in a way that does not affirm the behavior. In Sweden, it's punishable up to 4 years of prison if you speak out against homosexual behavior. So you can see now where the full weight of the government is being used by homosexual activists to silence the church and to silence believers.
Craig Osten, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd. It was my pleasure.
Craig Osten is Vice President of Creative Services for the Alliance Defense Fund, and he's co-author of the new book. It's titled The Homosexual Agenda, Exposing the Principal Threat to Religious Freedom Today. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Craig Parton. Craig is the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for August called The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel. When apologetics is normally undertaken, we generally tend to think about it as dealing with the facts, and that is the bulk of good apologetic skill, dealing with the facts, the objective things, history, the texts, the facts, what actually occurred. And we've talked with Craig about that before. But there is another segment to which apologetics must be addressed in the skeptical world, and that is the skeptic who is not raising objections based so much on the facts, but based upon feelings. It may be the artist, it may be the poet, it may be the musician, it may just be your next door neighbor. But their objection is based upon subjective things, not the objective facts. They don't feel right about it. Their objection is a feeling-based thing. How do you do Christian apologetics? How do you defend the Christian faith with the tender-minded? We'll deal with that after this break. Join us, if you will, in the next half hour as we talk with Craig Parton about defending the Christian faith to the tender-minded. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Has the cross of Jesus Christ been replaced by self-improvement and self-fulfillment in many evangelical churches today? And how does Reformation theology differ from pop American Christianity? You'll find answers to these questions with the Issues Etc. book of the month for August, The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. The phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. The Defense Never Rests explains the grandeur and misery of American evangelicalism. The cost is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. The Defense Never Rests by Craig Parton, our Issues Etc. book of the month for August. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. That number again, 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on Buddhists and lets you learn a little about their beliefs. Buddhists believe that getting to a perfect state requires many cycles of birth and death. They think a person will be reincarnated, a concept that someone has to go through many cycles of birth, living, and death. Going through the cycles teaches a person to let go of attachment and desire. Buddhists also perform good deeds so they can gain merit in the afterlife. They believe that after many reincarnations, a person who lets go of all things related to self can reach nirvana, which is a state of liberation and freedom from suffering. Nirvana is a state of nothingness. Most Buddhists live in Asia, where they have little chance to hear about Jesus Christ and how he died once and rose again for his creation. Pray for Buddhists to discover Christ's love. Get prayer information on unreached people by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. He placed a 2.5-ton monument to the Ten Commandments in the state judicial building. But a federal judge says it's got to be gone by today because it suggests an establishment of religion. Roy Moore, Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, says, "I have no intention of removing the monument." You'll hear the argument made that the United States was founded as a Christian nation. That's not explicitly stated in the Constitution, although some old state constitutions do proceed on clear Christian assumptions. To say that we were founded as a Christian nation really comes from the fact that the majority of early Americans were Christians, more precisely Protestants. If today's religionists want to call America back to its heritage, let's adapt and say Judeo-Christian heritage, because we are not all Protestant, not all Christian, then the lesson of history is to make America more Judeo-Christian by winning more hearts, not by court decisions or controversial legislation. Forced obedience is no obedience. The First Amendment forbids the establishment of a national religion. Compared to America, Christianity is comatose in many countries where it has been the legally established religion. I'm Dale Meyer.
I'm Emma Wilkin. Join me every weekday morning for a fun Bible quiz that kids, and only kids, can play. Listen for my question each morning at 9:05 during Paul Clayton's morning show. Call with the right answer and win. Winners of the Bible Brain Teaser for kids only will get cool prize packages from Concordia Christian Books and Gifts. It's the Bible Brain Teaser for kids only here on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back. For the next 25 minutes of this first hour of Issues Etc., the author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, The Defense Never Rests, Craig Parton will join us to talk about defending the Christian faith to the tender-minded, the artist, the poet, the skeptic, but one who has an objection, not based upon the objective facts, but based upon, in fact, the feelings that they may have. We'll talk about that. Bob Alico joins us in the second hour of the program. He's co-founder of Discernment Ministry International. We're going to talk about the signs of an abusive church. He's come out of one of these. He's seen it from the inside out. He spends much of his time criticizing these things. We'll talk about that with him in the second hour of the program. Then Dr. Judith Reisman of the Institute for Media Education joins us to talk about this Kinsey report. 50 years ago today, Kinsey issued his report on the human female and her sexuality. We'll find out what its effect has been and whether or not that report had any integrity. Craig Parton is an attorney in Santa Barbara, California, a former staff member for Campus Crusade for Christ. He is the United States Director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, and author of our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August, The Defense Never Rests. Craig, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Todd.
How would you identify the tender-minded, as you call them in your book? How are they different from the tough-minded, the lawyerly types that we talked about before?
Well, you're right. Most of my book deals with the, quote, objective, historical, legal, philosophical, scientific evidences for the truth of the Christian faith that are critical. But many times, you know, people don't, they're not reached, they're not grabbed by historical or objective evidences. It's not as if what I call the tender-minded are offended by such evidences. It's just that they don't reach them at the place that they really live. They tend to make their decisions not based on evidences as an objective source, but on other considerations as to whether it seems to meet them on an existential level, whether it has aesthetic qualities that are pleasing to them. And so the tender-minded are those folks who live in the world generally of the arts, of poets, of musicians, and other people in that realm that we call the tender-minded. That distinction actually comes from Herbert Feigl, a philosopher who wrote a book that shows the distinction between tender and tough-minded people. And our point in dealing with them is that I think that there is an effective apologetic for the tender-minded that doesn't simply end up in the subjective realm.
Well, that's my concern, and I think it's probably the concern of any apologist who would say, not only am I accustomed to defending the Christian faith on the basis of the objective facts, but I'm wary of a pitfall of subjectivism, making the defense of the Christian faith to the skeptic, to the unbeliever, based upon feelings, knowing that feelings can't be trusted the same way facts can.
That's exactly right, and that's the precise objection that's raised to attempting to develop an apologetic to the tender-minded, that it appears that you are moving away from presenting objectivity, and aren't you therefore just falling into this subjective approach seen by so many today in the Christian church, where it's basically try Jesus, you'll like him, and your life will improve, and your kids will become oh so obedient. And my point in the book, in the section on the tender-minded, is that I believe very definitely that an objective apologetic is possible for these people. And in fact, in the area of the arts, has indeed been done. And there are good illustrations of how to go about doing this. The premise of it, Todd, is that if the scriptures are correct in diagnosing man's condition, that he is fractured internally, that even though people may on an intellectual level deny this or reject this in their conversation and in their writings, the sensitive ones intuitively understand that there is a problem in their life and on the most sensitive interior levels of their life that they are broken and that they are in need of redemption. This may not and certainly does not work itself out clearly in an understanding of the gospel, but that if we're correct that image has still been retained even by the non-believer, that he recognizes he has a problem and that he needs a solution outside of himself, that there may be a way of accessing that problem, of speaking to that problem on a deep level. And that's indeed what a number of the apologists that I refer to in the book have dealt with it, particularly the literary apologists in Lewis, Tolkien, Williams, and Sayers.
Well, in that very vein, I was just thinking about a conversation I had some time back with our mutual friend and your colleague, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. And he is fond of pointing out that the best of Western literature, and really the whole corpus of Western literature, has a reoccurring theme. Storytelling itself seems to be a story of redemption. He often says, in effect, this it can be a way, through the literary world, those who appreciate that form of the arts, can be a way of beginning a conversation with the skeptic.
Exactly. Why is it when you give a copy of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to, let's say, some friends that are having children who are now at the age where they can hear a story of some depth like that, why is it that even atheistic parents, when they read that story, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, at the critical point where Aslan lays his life down on the cold stone slab there in a redemptive fashion, the children will be weeping, and even the parents will have difficulty getting through that section. Why is that? And the point that, and Lewis was very sensitive to this, and it's very clear, and Tolkien also in his essay on fairy tales, is that this is speaking to the deepest levels of the human situation. There is a recognition that we are in need of this perfect sacrifice, that we are not worthy of it, and that if indeed that happened, it would be the greatest news of all. And that's kind of the verification that this kind of situation is indeed the case with the unbeliever, and that sensitive writers, the kinds of the Inklings, the Lewis Williams and Tolkien, they were able to understand that that is the situation in the human psyche, and were able to speak to it on this deep level in which there are no defenses. That's the wonder of this material, is that people somewhat know that you just gave them a book that evangelized them, but they can't really tell you to go put it where the sun don't shine. They realize this has happened on such a deep level that there really were no emotional defenses to the work, and that's why Lewis is so powerful in that kind of genre.
Are we really talking in general here about what Paul talks about in the opening chapters of the book of Revelation, that there is a natural knowledge of God and man's natural knowledge of a distance between him and God that he feels in his brokenness, his fallenness, he must somehow cross the distance. There's playing to this natural knowledge of God. What can
sure.
be known of God by what he made?
I think you're very much in that realm, and you're in that Romans 1 and 2 realm, where this is man, even though this isn't a recognition that he is in need of the work of Christ. It's a recognition that in his human condition, if he's a sensitive thinker, that he has tremendous problems. It's what the existentialist writers were getting at, that there is chaos, that there is hopelessness, that the world is a wicked place, and that they've contributed to it, that they have a role to play in the evil that's in this universe, and that they need an answer from outside of them. That's really as far as that kind of thing goes. And what the benefit of knowing this literary material particularly and giving it to non-Christians is, you can then, when the non-Christian says, oh, well, but, you know, we know that there's never been a visitation by an Aslan. If only there was an Aslan. And you begin to present to them the Christian gospel, and they say, well, that's just another fairy tale like Lewis's stuff. Then you can go into your hard, your tough-minded apologetic, showing them, no, this really is grounded in history. As Lewis says, you know, I've read a lot of fairy tales, and Luke is not a fairy story. This is not a guy who's doing myth. This is a historian of the first rank.
Okay, let's take the example of, let's just say we run across someone who is deeply steeped in the arts of music. They are a thoroughgoing musician. Music is their life. And we all know someone like this. Show us how. How would you approach someone based upon that that interest they have, that passion for the arts, in an apologetic way as a tender-minded skeptic?
Well, certainly a marvelous place to begin with somebody in the area of music is certainly to introduce them to the music of Johann Sebastian Bach. And in my book, I try to develop that, the importance of doing that, because Bach was a theologian of the first rank. And when you're working with Bach, you're working with solid Reformation theology. But more importantly, people recognize that in Bach, they are dealing with very high art. They are dealing with the musical art at the highest level it's possible. And in Bach, with now 171 CDs, the output is simply colossal. And there's no way to explain him away other than somebody who took theology exceedingly seriously. So where I would start with somebody who was interested in music at that kind of high levels is I would begin with things like the Goldberg Variations, not necessarily the sacred works of Bach. Introduce them to the Goldberg Variations. That music is absolutely awe-inspiring. The resolutions in that music, Bergman, the great filmmaker back in the early 60s who wrote The Silence and other despairing, pessimistic existential films, says that he had to turn off the Goldberg variations in order to write the script for that film. And that's how powerful that music is. And then to introduce that kind of person, bring them down the road to experiencing some of Bach's great sacred works, simply for the not only the musicality of them, but the recognition that, for example, in the great one, in the Mass in B minor, of course, or St. Matthew's Passion, you have works of such tremendous substance here that anybody who wants to be educated in the area of music just simply has to have contact with this and do it on the level of high art. I was recently at the Carmel Bach Festival in Carmel, and they were drawing the connections between Bach, Mendelssohn, and the Lutheran Reformation in lectures there, Todd, and they were all unbelievers as far as I could figure. They're fascinated with this. You know, leave it to us not to draw the parallels, but the unbelievers are just fascinated with where did Bach get the kind of philosophical worldview to create this kind of music.
Now, back to the pitfall, if we could, for just a second. The danger here then appears that we would simply affirm for the skeptic the aesthetic beauty of something like Bach or of great literature by Christians who understood what all myths were pointing toward. We would simply affirm the aesthetic qualities of these things and never actually get to what you were just saying. What was the worldview behind Johann Sebastian Bach's beautiful music? What drove him to create such beautiful things for the sake of Christ?
Right, right. And that's the way that we can do this. Recently, I was at Borders, it was at the Christmas time, and a guy, an unbeliever, but he's with a group, a quartet here in town, simply went over to Borders Music and said, do a little short presentation on Bach. And the first thing the place was packed out. The first thing he played was Bach's rendition of O Sacred Head. And he introduced it as saying, I'm not religious at all, but I'm now going to play for you the most beautiful music ever written. And there the evangel was presented in O Sacred Head. And so this stuff pushes in that direction. And certainly there are Bach interpreters, Schweitzer, for example, and others, Christoph Wolff, who have tried to minimize this aspect of Bach's personality and the importance of the gospel of Jesus Christ and the theology of the Lutheran Reformation. But that's not scholarship. That's not understanding the full realm of Bach's contribution, and I think to be an honest student of Bach, you have to understand where he came from.
Now, we've talked about the high art, the beautiful, the sublime. The arts of late have taken a darker turn into the nihilism that's of our generation, into a denial of truth, a denial of beauty, a denial of good and evil. Can the Christian apologist, the defender of the Christian faith, even use this darker stuff of late in order to open the door to the tender-hearted skeptic?
Yeah, that's what's known in apologetics as the negative route, the road of negativity, and not the road of affirmation. And you certainly can find this. You can find this in literature, in the work of the existentialists like Camus, The Plague, or The Stranger, Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit, or nausea. You can find this recognition of the sin of man, and it's important to have contact with that material and to be able to give people that material. I literally had a class in a church where we read that material as part of the class, and boy did I ever get heat from people. How could I possibly do that? And we read the French existentialists. We read a lot of this literature. We read Faulkner's Sound and the Fury. We read material that simply showed you from the sensitive writer's man's condition, not pointing to the gospel, but showing that he is fallen and that he is broken. And certainly film today does that. A lot of it is simply is not even worth the time to look at it because it's not serious enough to be making a statement about man's condition. But the serious filmmakers are still doing that. I mean, Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors, if you ever needed to have a look at a world in which there is no God and where conscience is your guide, watch that film.
Now, I guess one thing we've left unspoken here, and we cannot assume it, Craig, and that is that Christians in their everyday life will be familiar themselves with things like film or music or art or literature. If you're not, it doesn't sound like you can really engage in this kind of thing.
And that's, you know, that's the problem, that some people think, oh, you have to be an intellectual to care about this kind of thing. You know, my upbringing was the Beach Boys and, you know, the California beach culture, which is what I live in, not exactly the high level of seriousness. I had zero exposure to Bach, zero exposure to classical music, to the arts or literature and that. My education was California public schools. It's amazing I learned how to write, you know. So for people to say this stuff is really above our levels of access is simply not the case. In fact, great art, because it has a transcendent element, it is actually the kinds of material that you'll find the easiest access to, and the importance of challenging people to engage themselves in that material. I mean, right now at our church during the summertime, we're putting on Francis Schaeffer's films every Sunday morning after church and going through all of that material. And that is a marvelous introduction to the arts and to music and to literature, let alone history, and to understand it, and good study materials that we have as a result. And I challenge people to turn off cable TV, get off their rear ends, and read a book, listen to a Bach cantata, and they'll be amazed at the avenues of outreach that it will allow them to have. Because I mean, the point in apologetics is caring less about yourself and your own narrow, boring world, and care something about the world that is in real trouble today. Show that you care enough to other people to have read widely, you know, and expose yourself to a wide variety of cultural expressions that have apologetical value.
You know as well as I do, in fact, I think you probably know a fair bit better than I do, that in American evangelicalism today, there's not only an anti-intellectualism, there's also an attempt to create its own pop culture, as simplistic and as insipid as anything the secular pop culture could produce. Is this a major obstacle to what we've been talking about?
Oh, I think it very much is. It's tragic that it's the situation, but so much of what we think is hip and cutting-edge culture in the church is really terribly outdated. I wish I could tell young people that the encouragement that you should be getting will be there in your local church to pursue the arts, to pursue filmmaking, to pursue painting and music of a high level. That's what it ought to be. That's where I'd like to see elders and churches spending their time talking about. How can we encourage our young people to pursue the arts within the context of solid theology? Because the place generally not to get it is to hang around our churches. I mean, just look how most of them look. Just, I mean, aesthetically. Not exactly producing of a lot of intellectual creativity or artistic creativity. We ought to be commissioning works of art in our churches. We ought to be commissioning people to write great music in our churches. We ought to be encouraging the poets and artists and all of that back in the churches. And that's our heritage, Todd, in the Reformation. That's the heritage of the Lutheran Reformation, is an affirmation of the arts. And where is that today? You know, we'd make a great impact if we had that kind of attractiveness in our communities. I really think we would see people incredibly intrigued with a God that positively looked on artistic expression.
With only a minute and a half here before we need to wrap this up, Craig, there's going to be someone who says, look, I'm a little leery of the arts because I know what they depict in past, present, and future. I'm afraid that if I encourage, say, my college-age student to pursue an interest in the arts, that rather than making them equipped to do apologetics and defend the Christian faith among the tender-minded, it will lead them away from the Christian faith.
Yeah, that's something that is usually for people that are afraid that their kids haven't gotten enough solid theology to deal with this, and that's really our problem, is we haven't trained kids in solid enough theology, in a history of Western ideas, in the stuff they should be getting in our high school classes, etc. So they have utterly no defenses when they go out to deal with secularism. And that is the problem. But if we have been bringing these kids up not only to know their theology, which we're very good as Lutherans to make sure they're catechized, but apologetics, which means they're having contact with the objections to the Christian faith and how to deal with them. And they're going through Schaeffer's, for example, Schaeffer's film series. And they've seen it a couple of times before they go to the university. Then you set up a foundation that says your theology is not only true, it can deal with the world. And not only that, it can keep you on the right path so that when you pursue the arts, you do these for the glory of God and not for your own man-centered pleasures, which is precisely where the arts are today. I mean, John Cage, Music by Chance, just created an organ piece that's first intermission is in the year 2319, Todd. That's where secular man is now. Music is just technology. It's just sound. It has nothing to do with being done for the glory of God and to honor the gospel.
Craig Parton, thank you for being our guest.
My pleasure, Todd.
Craig will be back tomorrow. We'll be talking about answering the tough questions from skeptics. We'll get his take on that tomorrow on Issues, Etc. He's an attorney in Santa Barbara, California, a former staff member at Campus Crusade for Christ, the United States Director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, and author of our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August. It's called The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel. You can purchase this book for $9.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House in the next hour, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040 is their number. Just mention Issues, Etc., the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month, and they'll send you The Defense Never Rests, 1-800-325-3040. You can also order the book online at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section and you'll find information on The Defense Never Rests by Craig Parton. issuesetc.org is the address, or you can always call Concordia Publishing House during this break and in the next hour, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Bob Lico is with us for the second hour of Issues, Etc. Bob came out of the Word Faith movement. It wasn't just Word Faith. It was, upon retrospect, Bob says, an abusive movement, an abusive church. We'll find out how you can tell whether or not you are involved or someone you know is involved in an abusive church right after this break.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.